Bien, je crois que nous allons commencer parce que le temps nous est compté. I think we should start now because we have to leave at 5:30. It's a must. So, mon nom est Paul Beaugrand-Champagne. Je suis maintenant à la retraite. J'ai été cadre de l'information et journaliste toute ma vie et je suis maintenant plutôt consultante en information. Everybody understands French, I guess. Yes? Okay. Les trois conférenciers que nous avons aujourd'hui concernant les politiques financières vont vous présenter trois expériences totalement différentes. La première, qui est tirée du monde des grandes entreprises, va nous être présentée par M. Arnaud Anciaux, qui est doctorant en sciences de l'information et de la communication à l'Université Rennes 1 et PhD en communication publique à l'Université Laval. Ensuite, il sera question d'une expérience qui est un online success et qui nous vient de la Nouvelle-Écosse. C'est un modèle concernant la nouvelle locale. Et ça nous sera présenté par Mme Kelly Talkhill, School of Journalism, University of King's College. Et la troisième expérience va nous être présentée par Drew Oyaji. I had it. co-founder of Dominion and the Media Co-op. So, a third experience cooperative. Nous allons commencer avec M. Anciaux, qui a intitulé sa conférence « Redéfinir la fonction économique du journalisme dans un groupe médiatique, Québécois, Internet et le public ». Je donne maintenant la parole à M. Anciaux. Allez-y.
De bien vouloir accueillir ma présentation. Je suis très content d'être là. Et je vais vous présenter en fait donc un travail de recherche qui est issu de mes travaux donc de doctorat. Et donc je travaille sur au Québec sur le groupe Québecor. Donc ça va être peut-être un peu moins sur le journalisme, les citoyens, l'open data, mais mon but en fait dans mes travaux, c'est d'interroger dans un grand groupe médiatique, pour ne pas dire le plus grand groupe médiatique au Québec, un des plus gros au Canada, de voir comment le journalisme a évolué et comment notamment sur la dernière décennie, les 15 dernières années, la fonction assignée au journalisme, le rôle qui est donné par les journalistes, par les travailleurs, par les dirigeants, par les cadres, par le public, par tous les acteurs qui gravitent autour du groupe, comment le journalisme a vu sa fonction être redéfinie, notamment par des commandes, des décisions, des choix économiques. Donc, je vais essayer de vous présenter un peu mes premiers résultats qui sont issus de plusieurs analyses. Je travaille à la fois sur le modèle économique en tant que tel, donc c'est-à-dire le modèle financier du groupe Québecor, mais aussi sur les discours qui entourent le groupe. Discours officiels qu'on retrouve par exemple dans les rapports annuels, dans les différentes interventions des dirigeants, mais aussi les discours tenus par les travailleurs qui font partie du groupe, aussi les discours qui sont issus d'autres acteurs, par exemple les concurrents de Québecor. Et donc, c'est un peu les deux aspects que je vais aborder. Alors, pour comprendre le modèle d'affaires économique du groupe, on peut s'intéresser tout d'abord à ce que veulent mettre dans le groupe et dans la fonction du journalisme, tout d'abord ceux qui travaillent quotidiennement dans le groupe, ceux qui sont les journalistes, qui sont très nombreux évidemment dans un groupe de l'ampleur de Québecor, qui est donc le premier groupe médiatique au Québec et un des premiers au Canada. Alors, ce qu'ils mettent dans le modèle d'affaires, ce que les journalistes veulent comme fonction économique pour le journalisme, est issu de plusieurs choses. Des revendications qui sont issues des syndicats, des associations professionnelles, mais aussi les choix, les stratégies individuelles particulières de chaque journaliste qui, dans son travail quotidien, dans ses négociations, dans sa production de contenu, réalise un certain nombre de choix. De l'autre côté, on a, pour créer ou élaborer cette place, cette fonction économique du journalisme, on a évidemment ce qui est attendu, demandé, exigé parfois par les directions et notamment par la direction centrale du groupe, qui donne donc des ordres, qui répartit les tâches entre les travailleurs, mais aussi entre les différentes instances. Je vais vous présenter notamment l'exemple du développement de l'agence QMI, donc l'agence de presse interne lancée par le groupe Québecor. Évidemment, ça appartient avant tout à la direction de choisir quelles sont les tâches qui restent entre les mains des journalistes de différents médias, par exemple du Journal de Montréal, des chaînes de télévision qui composent TVA Nouvelles, des journaux, par exemple, qu'on va retrouver aussi dans le Canada anglophone, qui sont membres de Sun Media. Et aussi, c'est aussi très important, c'est la direction centrale du groupe qui va décider d'investir, de retirer un certain nombre d'investissements financiers ou de mettre en avant certaines instances au sein du groupe Québecor. Par exemple, puisque c'est l'exemple que je vais développer, notamment un investissement assez fortement dans la mise en place de cette agence QMI. Et donc, si je pose un peu ces premiers points, c'est parce que j'estime que pour la fonction économique du journalisme apparaît comme un arbitrage, un choix issu d'un arbitrage continu entre les attentes des journalistes d'un côté et les attentes de la direction managériale du groupe Québecor. Alors, je vous ai mis une balance assez équilibrée. Évidemment, on peut penser qu'aujourd'hui, le rapport de force et la balance penchent plus d'un côté que de l'autre. Mais bon, ça, c'est évidemment quelque chose qui est à comprendre plus loin. Et donc, issu de ce rapport de force et aussi du discours des acteurs, on aboutit donc à cet arbitrage. Et donc, mon analyse porte sur, on va dire, une combinaison de ce rapport de force et de ce discours. Alors, pour vous présenter un peu le modèle économique, très rapidement, c'est des chiffres, c'est le peu de chiffres qu'on obtient du groupe Québecor et qui sont publics. Je vais essayer de pas rester trop longtemps dessus. Donc, tout d'abord, là, je vous présente le bénéfice en fonction des différents secteurs de Québecor. Vous voyez, ça bouge beaucoup, évidemment. Ce qu'on voit, donc je ne vais pas rentrer dans tous les détails, ce qui est important de voir, c'est que depuis très nombreuses années, avant même l'arrivée ou le développement des technologies numériques, tous, on va dire, le pôle médiatique, c'est-à-dire qui regroupe la télévision, le journalisme de presse écrite, ont toujours été dominés économiquement dans le groupe Québecor. C'est-à-dire que jusqu'au tournant des années 2000, l'activité principale de Québecor est ce qui a été beaucoup commenté comme étant la vache à lait de Québecor, c'est-à-dire ce qui apporte beaucoup de bénéfices, qui fait vivre le groupe, ça a été les activités d'impression avec Québecor World. Et ce rôle est depuis l'acquisition de Vidéotron, donc du groupe de Cablo Distribution Vidéotron. Désormais, c'est donc les activités de diffusion Internet, d'accès à la téléphonie fixe et mobile qui ont pris ce relais. Et ce qui fait que, quand on réfléchit à la fonction économique, déjà on voit que, sur juste un point de vue financier, évidemment, le journalisme n'est pas l'activité première de Québecor. Et surtout, si on s'intéresse dans chaque secteur à la marge d'exploitation sectorielle, c'est-à-dire disons de manière très, très simplifiée, au bénéfice qui est tiré de chaque activité, on voit qu'il y a une très, très large différence. Tout à l'heure, on parlait du fait que on pouvait encore tirer des profits du journalisme et de l'activité médiatique au Québec et au Canada. Ça reste néanmoins sans commune mesure avec les bénéfices qui sont tirés de l'activité de câble distribution, puisqu'on arrive pratiquement à 50% de bénéfices. Alors, cette présentation économique, elle a un intérêt surtout parce qu'elle sert de justification à un certain nombre de changements donc, qui ont été mis en place depuis près de 10 ans, en tout cas depuis 2000, et c'est souvent évidemment associé à la prise de direction par M. Pierre-Carl Péladeau, donc fils de son père, fils du précédent dirigeant du groupe. Et donc je vais insister plus particulièrement sur ce qui a été mis en avant comme une rationalisation de la production d'informations afin d'augmenter cette marge d'exploitation sectorielle afin que l'information, la production d'informations soit plus rentable. Et donc c'est comme ça qu'a été, a été justifié au sein du groupe Québécois, à la fois dans les discours publics, mais aussi interprété par les cadres intermédiaires, les directions des différents médias. C'est la mise en place d'une rationalisation de la production d'informations qui a consisté notamment à mettre en place donc, cette agence QMI, qui a un rôle central à la fois de décision, mais ce que j'ai un peu pu constater, c'est que derrière le processus qui était envisagé par la direction, cette mise en place est plus complexe et on peut retrouver certaines options qui ont été choisies. Donc ça a été mis en avant, cette agence de presse donc, qui a remplacé un certain nombre de productions d'informations comme là, c'est des journalistes mais aussi des cadres qui me l'ont confié comme un cost center, c'est-à-dire que le but est vraiment de créer une instance qui va récupérer un certain nombre de coûts de manière centrale et qui va permettre de diminuer les coûts de la production de l'information, à la fois en sortant de la coopérative qui est la presse canadienne, mais aussi en produisant de l'information pour tous les médias de manière centralisée, tous les médias de Québecor, plutôt que de payer, puisque c'est vraiment le nerf de la question qui est derrière, de payer un certain nombre de journalistes dans les différents médias qui feraient leur travail ou qui faisaient leur travail de manière indépendante ou qui faisaient leur travail en tout cas dans leurs médias par rapport à la ligne éditoriale qui était propre à leurs médias. Alors ce rôle central, cette direction au-dessus des médias, donc a été recherchée par le groupe, toujours justifiée de manière économique. Parfois, les journalistes comprennent qu'il y a un problème derrière cela, puisqu'on aboutit à une uniformisation de la production d'informations, en tout cas pour le groupe, mais la justification est toujours économique. Néanmoins, cette mise en place, et c'est peut-être là où il y a des processus de réflexion sur encore le rôle public que peut jouer l'information produite dans le groupe Québécois, c'est qu'on retrouve quand même des limites à ce processus de convergence, d'intégration de la production de l'information. Tout d'abord, on observe encore le maintien d'entités séparées. C'est-à-dire que la logique du processus qui a été mis en place serait d'avoir une seule entité qui s'appellerait l'agence QMI ou qui s'appellerait Québécois Média et qui produirait toute l'information. Or, on a encore de l'information qui est produite au niveau de certains médias, donc l'agence QMI au niveau central, mais les différents journaux de TVA Nouvelles pour la télédiffusion. Et surtout, en fait, ce maintien d'entités séparées existe également avec une absence de vision claire de ce que doit venir l'information sur Québécois. Je m'explique. On a, si on regarde sur une perspective de 10 ans, un mouvement, changeant. Ce n'est pas un mouvement unidirectionnel, mais c'est un mouvement qui change constamment, de savoir est-ce qu'on centralise ou est-ce qu'on ne centralise pas. Par exemple, sur Internet, on a la création au début de la décennie, autour des années 2000, c'est déjà la décennie précédente, d'un portail commun qui regroupait toute la production d'information, enfin toute l'offre d'information sur Internet, qui est toujours le portail Canoë, et tous les médias, toutes les marques médiatiques étaient associées à ce portail-là. Et donc c'était cette logique de centralisation, mais qui depuis a été rescindée en différents médias. Par exemple, le Journal de Montréal a son propre site, le Journal de Québec a son propre site, TVA Nouvelle a son propre site. Et donc on a cette constante évolution où il y a des revendications des journalistes, mais aussi, on va dire, des cadres intermédiaires de ces différents médias pour continuer à exister en tant que tels et parfois même à retrouver une certaine, en tout cas à chercher, on va pas non plus être trop optimiste, à chercher à retrouver une autonomie dans leur diffusion, dans leur relation avec leur public. Et donc ça montre quand même qu'il y a, même s'il y a une volonté en tout cas affichée dans les discours de la direction de cette unidirectionnalité de la logique de convergence, on a quand même des changements assez fréquents dans les stratégies telles qu'elles sont appliquées, mises en place au sein des différents médias. Pour vous donner un exemple, par exemple, c'est l'exemple de Montopo qui a été mis en place par TVA Nouvelle. Donc Montopo qui est l'appel fait auprès des Québécois pour qu'ils envoient des images, des vidéos sur des événements qui arrivent, qu'ils voient. Par exemple, prendre en photo des manifestations, des accidents, ou que sais-je. En général, c'est plutôt des faits divers. Cette mise en place, donc plutôt, on va dire, réussite, puisqu'ils ont réussi quand même à recevoir des contenus, est interprétée de manière très différente selon les personnes que j'ai pu rencontrer. C'est-à-dire qu'il y a des personnes qui vont être extrêmement critiques, qui vont voir cette expérience comme simplement le remplacement des journalistes, c'est-à-dire, je cite à peu près ce qu'on m'a dit, c'est-à-dire qu'on demande aux citoyens d'envoyer des photos et des vidéos pour occuper 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes d'audience de télévision chaque jour, pardon, plutôt que de créer du contenu qui coûte cher à produire. Mais du côté, par exemple, des promoteurs de cette expérience Montopo, on ne va pas non plus justifier en disant que c'est un journalisme citoyen, que ça va favoriser l'information dans le public, mais on va dire tout simplement que c'est une logique concurrentielle, et le but étant ici de damer le pion à la concurrence, à Radio-Canada, au groupe GSK, pour avoir des informations moins chères, mais surtout beaucoup plus rapidement. Et donc il y a des différences d'interprétation qu'on retrouve dans ces stratégies-là. Alors comme j'ai déjà pas mal discuté, je vais aborder juste le dernier point de ma présentation. C'est que en analysant les discours qui sont portés, les discours officiels, les discours des différents acteurs qui composent le groupe Québecor, mais aussi à l'extérieur, j'ai remarqué, j'ai essayé de comprendre la mise en place ou l'apparition d'un espace, dans ce que j'ai appelé un espace discursif de justification. C'est-à-dire que peu importe en fait la vision, qu'elle soit positive ou négative, des stratégies mises en place dans Québecor, souvent les arguments pour expliquer ce qu'il se passe sont les mêmes. Les problématiques économiques, tout à l'heure on disait que un intervenant disait à juste titre, je pense que le problème n'est pas celui du journalisme uniquement, mais celui des modèles d'affaires du journalisme. C'est quelque chose qui revient très fréquemment, qui sont des pratiques, l'invocation d'une crise du journalisme qui serait plus ou moins liée au développement des technologies numériques. Tous ces aspects, tous ces sujets sont utilisés pour justifier, à la fois en positif comme en négatif, les stratégies, la compréhension des stratégies par les acteurs, par les journalistes, par les travailleurs, par les cadres dirigeants. Et donc, ce qui est intéressant pour comprendre aussi l'évolution potentielle du journalisme et de son financement au Québec, c'est d'essayer de voir une vision d'ensemble où non seulement on a des stratégies qui sont issues de rapports de force, mais aussi une discussion assez continue, je pense, avec des justifications qui sont prises dans le groupe, mais aussi ailleurs. Par exemple, si on prend le cas du Québec, souvent on va chercher des justifications en disant c'est Radio-Canada qui fait pareil, Radio-Canada fait de l'intégration, et donc nous, à Québecor, nous allons faire la même chose. GSK développe un certain nombre de convergences dans, par exemple, la création d'un portail commun pour ces différents titres de presse. Donc, nous allons faire la même chose. Et ce qui est intéressant de voir, c'est que au-delà des, voilà, des choix individuels stratégiques, par exemple de la nouvelle direction de Québecor, ou des volontés de rentabilisation, rationalisation de la production d'informations dans le cadre économique de Québecor, on va toujours chercher à l'extérieur des justifications, en l'occurrence principalement pour le Canada, chez Radio-Canada, pour le Québec chez Radio-Canada et chez donc GESCA Power Corporation. On va aussi chercher des justifications à l'extérieur. C'est-à-dire que souvent, ce qui est invoqué, c'est la crise du journalisme aux États-Unis, où on en a un peu parlé dans la journée aussi, et je pense que ça correspond bien, c'est-à-dire de dire un certain nombre de titres de presse ont fermé, des journalistes ont été mis à la porte, renvoyés, des postes ont été fermés aux États-Unis dans un certain nombre de titres de presse. Et donc, c'est une justification pour aller de l'avant et pour augmenter la rationalisation, entre guillemets, de la production de l'information. Et la conséquence étant concrètement une augmentation de la rentabilité de la presse chez Québecor. Et donc, pour conclure très rapidement, ce qu'on peut observer, c'est la constitution de manière discursive d'un champ de présence donc au sens que portait Michel Foucault, où les acteurs, qu'ils soient issus de la sphère publique ou issus de la sphère privée, y compris d'une sphère privée qui a un objectif clair de rentabilité, vont chercher à l'extérieur un certain nombre de vérités, d'arguments de vérité, d'arguments d'autorité qui leur permettent de justifier, de mettre en place et de favoriser les stratégies qui sont, elles, souvent bien contraires à la déontologie du journalisme. Voilà, je vous remercie beaucoup pour votre attention.
Merci, Monsieur Anciaux. Je vous ai laissé un peu déborder. Nous allons maintenant parler de la Nouvelle-Écosse, d'une expérience qui se vit en Nouvelle-Écosse. Kelly Toghill will present a decade of online success, the All Nova Scotia business model for local news.
Okay, you can hear me? I'm the right distance from everybody and everything? Good. I'm here to talk about a success story, allnovascotia.com. It's a local online site that has been profitable for 11 years, was launched without any foundation grants, without any government grants, and that carries no debt. Why don't we just leave the journalism strategies up?
Actually, we've got it right here.
Okay. So All Nova Scotia, and it has no debt. It's vibrant, it's serious, it's influential, and guess what? It employs 11 full-time professional journalists at the same rates as the union wages paid by its competitor. So in the current environment, All Nova Scotia is really kind of sort of astonishing. So All Nova Scotia generates an average of 2 dozen news stories a day. It covers business news, local politics, all aspects of municipal and provincial policy. It regularly breaks stories that are followed by traditional media such as the Chronicle Herald and CBC Online. So here's the really, really interesting part. All Nova Scotia defies almost every commonly accepted best practice in online journalism. It has no multimedia. No pictures, no video, no graph, no timeline, nothing. It is purely text. Stories are short, they're pretty traditional. You and I might consider most of them kind of dry. All Nova Scotia completely ignores audience engagement. It has no interaction, right? Hallmark of online. It doesn't engage in social media. It has no Facebook site, no Twitter feed. It doesn't even have a comment function on its website. It's done a lot of other, frankly, really weird things. It doesn't use analytics at all, and you'll see why. Analytics just don't work for it. So here's the biggest shocker for most of us in the room, which is that All Nova Scotia, since it started 11 years ago, has been, since the very first day, behind a hard paywall. No one can read All Nova Scotia without a subscription. And subscriptions are not cheap. They're $30 a month. For that, up to 3 people can have their own separate logins. The site is text only, but it's produced in Flash, so it's really hard to cut and paste. Not only that, David Bentley, who's the founder, has blocked spiders, so browsers can't even, you know, its content doesn't even show up in a search function. So needless to say, they don't spend a lot of time thinking about SEO in the All Nova Scotia newsroom. It didn't ignore all technological advances. All Nova Scotia did develop a daily email newsletter, and it issues bulletins. And it was one of the very first news services, I think it was actually the first news service in Halifax, to make itself available on BlackBerry and then on iPhone. So a lot of other business-to-business news organizations have proven they can generate substantial revenues with a subscription-based model by focusing on news and information that's valuable in the commercial marketplace, you know, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg. But it's not only business and financial news that fits this structure. Trade journals also do something similar. That's not revolutionary. All Nova Scotia appears to have morphed the business-to-business model and applied it to a consumer editorial product. So All Nova Scotia did start out as a local online business journal, but it expanded really quickly. It added political and business news, or it has political and business news. It also covers civil courts, a beat that no other media in Halifax covers on a regular basis. And it really eschews the kind of soft news that is really often associated with revenue generation. So you very, very rarely see human interest stories, every once in a while. But there's no enticement to its menu of hard news. No horoscopes, no games, no contests, no lifestyle features. It does cover business sales and developments, but it also reports fully on city council, 5 universities, provincial legislature, Canada's largest military base, the local school system, hospitals, regulated professions, and pretty much all aspects of provincial government. By 2006, so it started as subscription only. By 2006, agencies had petitioned Bentley to modify the site because they wanted to put advertisements on it and reach his affluent and influential audience. So now about 20% of the company's revenues come from advertising, and there are 6,000 individual logins. So Bentley won't reveal, or at least he won't tell me, how many of those readers are on multiple subscriptions. So that means the total combined revenues of the site are between $1 and $3 million a year. All Nova Scotia's subscription base is small, but its impact extends far beyond immediate readers. Because its readers are really the political, economic, and intellectual elite of Nova Scotia, not to put too fine a point on it, all of its enterprise journalism is followed by its competitors. This means that the broad social impact of All Nova Scotia has been, I think, quite profound. So All Nova Scotia is a paradox of innovation. It defies almost every rule of online journalism. The world expects online news to be multimedia, social, and free. All Nova Scotia is text only, has no social media presence, no user engagement, and is hidden behind a paywall. So, why does this work? Well, I don't really know, but I'm going to pretend to know for the next minute or two. The business model is deceptively simple. All Nova Scotia is the third financially successful media property launched by serial entrepreneur David Bentley. He launched the Bedford Sackville Daily News, and then he launched Frank Magazine in Halifax, which morphed into or was replicated in Ottawa. His business philosophy has been consistent throughout, which is keep overhead low and don't borrow money. So Frank was printed on newsprint, and it was run out of a, and this is not a euphemism, a rat-infested warren over a greasy spoon in Halifax. All Nova Scotia is the cyber equivalent. It is produced in Flash with no multimedia. So Bentley has ignored the tools that, you know, people like me love to play with in favor of delivering what his audience actually wants, which is fast, accurate information about their own town. The entire All Nova Scotia news organization is focused on one thing: content, content, content. So this has led him to defy accepted practices in a couple of other ways. There are no news meetings at All Nova Scotia, and the site hires top talent. So in a decade, In a decade of operation, there has never been a broad formal discussion in the newsroom about what should be covered. There is no assignment desk. Reporters own their beats. There is an expectation that they will never, ever be scooped by the competition. Those who are don't last. A copy editor reads most stories before they're posted, but they can be posted directly by reporters if necessary. Now, in the early days, Bentley also encouraged reporters to sell subscriptions. Obviously not a traditional news practice. You know, an absolute departure. And most would consider that a conflict of interest. It doesn't seem to have stifled enterprise reporting at all, Nova Scotia, and they have broken many scandals about people who were also subscribers. Reporters and editors do not have anything to do with the ad side, other than the fact that they do share physical space. There is no physical wall between the newsroom and the one guy who handles ads, but reporters have nothing to do with ads. So Bentley's also ignored common practice in his hiring policies. You know, a lot of local news sites and startups rely on an owner and one or two poorly paid reporters, supplemented with free information from people who are, quite keen. Citizen journalists, we've been calling them today. Bentley recruited experienced journalists with strong reputations and new journalists with great promise. And perhaps more important, he matched the pay scale of established media in Halifax. So all Nova Scotia has hired people away from the Chronicle Herald and Global News. Conversely, established media also raid all Nova Scotia for talent. So the example of all Nova Scotia is particularly relevant at a time when other news sites are moving toward a paid content model. The question is whether it has succeeded largely because it ignored commonly accepted best practices or in spite of doing so. And I do want to stress, I'm so glad that Media Co-op is on this panel with me, because I want to stress that this is, you know, this is not the Holy Grail. This is one potential success model. So the experience of Nova Scotia, all Nova Scotia, also raises two questions. Would this model succeed in other jurisdictions? And if so, what policies can be developed to encourage that transfer? Bentley doesn't think that the model is easily exportable to other jurisdictions. He thinks all Nova Scotia benefits from two things unique to Nova Scotia. A weak local media that has been dominated for a century by a monopoly newspaper with a remarkably passive editorial style, and a relatively closed society in which most key decision makers know each other. However, Nova Scotia is not the only place with an informal oligarchy and a passive media, so those factors should not be a barrier to export. So governments can do two things to encourage similar models elsewhere in Canada: create consumer tax breaks for subscriptions, and create new research streams that produce results faster than existing research funding systems. So it's unclear today what percentage of all Nova Scotia's subscription base is supported by employers who receive a business expense-related tax advantage, and what is paid for by local residents with after-tax dollars. I think it's pretty clear that local companies that buy subscriptions probably wouldn't do that if they couldn't write it off. So some see all Nova Scotia's funding model is closer to NPR or PBS than Politico Pro or Bloomberg, with corporate subscriptions forming a form of sponsorship. So in some cases, the sponsorship might be motivated by a desire to bolster civic society. I know in one particular case, it was a condition of employment and part of a benefits package. So government should consider instituting a new tax credit for individuals who subscribe to Canadian journalism publications. Canadian journalism, whether it's lifestyle journalism, sports, daily news, fosters civic society. It's a public good in the same way that sport for children is a public good, which also has a tax credit. So it would benefit media outlets such as All Nova Scotia, but it would also benefit legacy media and other new media ventures. And if you want to hear more about my second recommendation, you could ask questions because I'm out of time.
Thank you. I hope there will be questions about the second part, because it was very interesting. And now we will be talking about the cooperative model. And Drew Oyadje, co-founder of Dominion and the Media Co-op, as entitled is intervention, potential and challenges of the cooperative model. Here he is.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I was just trying to save time. Cool. So I'd just like to thank the organizers. This is a really interesting conference. And thanks for inviting me at the last minute. I'm actually taking a spot of someone else, I think, who couldn't come. So I was told that I was supposed to have two different policy proposals, and I got so excited about this that I decided to base my entire talk around them. But one of the things about policy proposals is the current government, which is unlikely to use any policy proposals that I would propose. Indeed, they would probably be likely to use them as things to avoid actively. So I decided to take a sort of a more expansive version of policy, which is to extend it to individual political choice and activity. So my first policy is that we should support the student strike. As you see, as I saw kind of coming in, it seems like some people are already ahead of me on this, so I'm excited that I'm not speaking to a totally hostile audience. But I, you know, just show of hands, does anyone see this as obviously having to do with financing cooperative journalism? There's two people, three, four, good, five, excellent. So I'm not totally alone. I'll try to convince the rest of you in short order. So this is the sort of model of politics that we have right now. Opportunities for participation are the exception rather than the rule. Going to a party convention, consulting with an MP, these are exceptional states of being for the average citizen. And this is what it looks like. I mean, you have a lot of passive consumers of some kind of media who eventually change their opinions about which parties they favor, vaguely, and that's pretty much the political arena is trying to make these little lines shift slightly. The student strike, on the other hand, I think is a really exciting development in terms of the kind of political life that people lead. And here the student strike could really be it's a stand-in for a lot of different things. It could be Occupy, it could be any kind of social movement where there's active participation. But one of the really interesting things about the student strike or the student movement in general, is that you have these regular general assemblies where people get together, they discuss things, and participating in collective decision making and politics is not an exceptional state. It's the rule. So one thing is that the student strike is part of a broader conflict that's going on. It's been a conflict for a long time, but it's just hasn't really been as noticeable because people haven't really been fighting back. But there's a major trend toward inequality. Inequality in terms of absolute wealth distribution, absolutely, but also inequality in terms of access to power, access to decision making. So this directly leads into sort of, I think, along the same spectrum between equality and inequality. You have, on the one hand, meaningful participation, so people people in societies where power is more equally distributed are able to meaningfully participate. And I think those two things are, one doesn't lead to the other, but they affirm themselves. And on the other hand, inequality tends to affirm isolation and consumption as the main modes of being and vice versa. So in the end, this affects the kind of journalism that we have. On the one hand, you have journalism that becomes more entertainment. I think by necessity, by definition, because in a society where people aren't empowered to participate meaningfully in the decision making of the society, there's no reason to be informed, except for for the people who do have access to decision-making power, so a very small minority. But on the other hand, in a place in a society where wealth and decision-making power are equally distributed, people are going to hunger for journalism. And I think this affects directly the kind of model, the kind of journalism that's possible, the kind of business models that are possible. So in this scenario, where it's all about making these little lines move, and people don't actually have that much participation or decision-making power, you're going to have a lot more passive consumers. You're going to have a lot more advertising-driven business models, and you're going to have power concentrated in a small owner class, especially when it comes to media, but in general as well. In this model, I think you're going to have a lot of opportunity for people to get together and say, hey, we want to make our own media. We want control over it. We want a democratic say, not only in, you know, which of the four, you know, newspapers that are all owned by the same people who go to the same cocktail parties, but we're actually going to have direct control over it, not just consumer choice. So in terms of my policy proposals, I would urge you to hit the streets. This Sunday is a great time to do that. To tell stories about what's going on. If you're a journalist, that's hopefully your job. So I urge you to do that, even if it's not paid. And insist on accuracy. I mean, even if you're you know, in journalism and you don't feel comfortable taking an editorial stand or you know, compromising your objectivity, such as it is, I think that there's a huge amount of inaccurate coverage. There's a lot of attacks going on, and a lot of really inaccurate information is being distributed. So at the very least, we can insist on basic journalistic standards being applied to that. Which leads me to policy number two, that we need more financing for co-ops. It's that simple. More money and more space to create cooperative models of journalism. What do I mean by that? Let's talk about it. So I think the important thing to understand about media, at least for me, is the major imbalances of power that are happening right now. And these are getting worse and worse. Journalists complain about it. Owners don't complain about it. Advertisers seem relatively okay. The audience just seems to be like, what is going on? So in the current situation, owners are really have the most power, by far the most power of any of the groups that are involved in journalism production. The audience, I would say, has the least. You know, basically, audiences are relegated to consumer choice. Journalists have less and less. I think there was a time when journalists were more unionized, they had more power. I do think that labor struggles are a big part of increasing the power of journalists, which I'll talk about in a bit. Advertisers do have a large amount of power, mostly because they are a lot of the content that we see in media. You know, by percentage, they actually define what the content of much of the media is. You know, even if it's not journalism, although it is, advertorials are often, you know, something that a lot of outlets do. So the first example I want to look at is Rue Frontenac. And I think this really illustrates the difference or the amount of power that's exercised in the newsroom. The Journal de Montréal is not known as, you would not use the words progressive, you would not use the words left wing, you would not use the words fair, no, maybe you would, but certainly not the first two. What's really interesting is that when the workers at the Journal de Montréal were locked out, what happened was they started their own newspaper. And to look at the two newspapers side by side, the Journal de Montréal and the newspaper that was subsequently produced by the exact same journalists, it's remarkable. It's just like night and day. It's a completely different situation. It was a really interesting project, and I won't go into it too in-depth, but the archives are online. xrufrontenac.ca, I think. It's easy to find on Google. But suffice to say that it was a very interesting experiment, and they actually were getting investor interest. And I remember talking to some of the journalists who were there while they were while they're sort of concluding the final buyout agreement after the toward the end of the lockout, you know, and they were talking about forming a cooperative. And what was the main problem with forming a cooperative? Cooperative meaning you have the workers would have democratic control over their workplace the way they did during the strike, or the, sorry, during the lockout. The main barrier to that was financing, straight up. There were investors who were interested, but they were not interested in financing a cooperative. They were interested in financing a business that was controlled by an owner. So I think this highlights how differently the power relations in media could look if things were done differently. So in the case of a worker co-op, like was one of the options on the table for Uru Frontenac. You have the journalists are basically the owners, and then they have a relationship with the audience and the advertisers. Because they're the owners, that actually like shifts the whole dynamics of power and the dynamics of control significantly. One example that I've actually been a part of, which is you know far smaller scale, but still pretty interesting, is the Journal Ensemble, which is a newspaper that's oriented toward the co-op movement in Quebec, which is quite a bit larger than the co-op movement anywhere else in Canada or North America, for that matter. I think the most notable thing about the Journal Ensemble is that it's got a lot of backing from the co-op sector, but more importantly, it's gotten backing from its members. When people are asked to write for Journal Ensemble, they unfortunately can't be paid, but they're not compensated either. The way they're paid is by basically a $200 share in the co-op and a membership. So you become a voting member and effectively a part owner of the co-op at the same and with an equal vote to anyone else. At the same time, your share it'll vest within, I think, a year and a half. So effectively, through their labor, the member owners of Journal Ensemble so far have given, have effectively financed the co-op to the tune of about $20,000, which is, I'm the first to admit, a very small amount. But I think it's an interesting way to think about the kind of financing that we can do. You can finance things with labor as well as with straight up money, which is a little more difficult to come by if you're a co-op. So there's another model, which is the model of the media co-op. How much time? 1 minute. Okay. Which is that we have both the audience and the journalists and the editors, for that matter, are all owners. Advertisers, such as they are on the outside. So the media co-op has a couple of different outlets across the country. There's the Co-op Media de Montréal. There's the Toronto Media Co-op. Each place has its own website. We have a participatory model whereby people can post their own news, but then we also pay writers and feature news that adheres to a higher standard. But everything's available on the site. So our goal is not so much to set a standard and only publish above it, but to give people the tools to differentiate between the coverage that shows up on the site. This is our member structure, which I don't think I'll be able to go into in negative 30 seconds. But suffice to say that we have three different kinds of members: editors, contributors, and readers. The readers provide the majority of our financing. So people give between, I guess, $15 a year on the low end and $100 a month on the high end. And we have about, I think, coming up on 300 members who give some dollar amount monthly, and then about 700 members total. So we're very small. We have a budget of about $100,000 a year. But it's completely democratically run, you know, by those three different member classes at the same time. So we like to think this to us anyway is what democratic media is, and I think we're excited to see more stuff like this happen, because it's very much an experiment. But so far, a fairly successful one. So we generate a huge amount of content. Each of the different locals, so the Vancouver, Halifax, Toronto, and Montreal, all have their own budgets, have their own collectives, editorial collectives, have their own. In the case of Toronto, Vancouver, and Halifax, have their own publications. Each one has their own website, and all of this comes together in the main Media Co-op website, and then the rest of it, and then a small selection of that content gets published in the Dominion. So I think the ideal case is that we have the government would provide a very strong backing to co-ops. I think the societal benefits are massive, and the risk is relatively small in terms of staking the capital for people to start their own co-ops, so that the next time there's a lockout at Le Journal de Montréal, the workers can just say, "See you later. We're starting our own newspaper. Good luck." I think that would be the ideal case, and it would go a long way to rectifying the power relations that I think are at the source of a lot of problems that are discussed at conferences like these, where journalists are like, "What are we going to do? How are we going to actually be able to create journalism and not have this ridiculous ideological control that's being exercised all the time?" A reasonable sort of interim solution, I think, is to look to the credit unions. Case Desjardins, I think, is worth billions of dollars. They could certainly do a lot more in terms of financing co-ops. And I think probably a lot of people are members. And they are democratically run, so I think there's a lot of opportunity there. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, three very interesting ways to finance the media, and they are not only different, they're very interesting in each of their sector. So we have 20 minutes to ask questions or give commentaries or whatever. There is someone with the microphone there that will go and see you.
My name is Monique Muse. I'm with the Gazette, and my question is for you. I was very interested in your presentation. I'm from Halifax, and I have actually done some work for All Nova Scotia. One of the interesting things, I think, whenever you see a new player on the scene in a city, media-wise, is that it can change how other outlets operate. It's not obviously not a closed system, and people respond to the kind of journalism that's being done in other outlets. That said, All Nova Scotia has it's been very insulated, and I would argue, even to the point of paranoia at some points, it's blocked. The email, anybody subscribing with a CBC email address, for instance, was blocked recently. Which I guess you could say is a good thing for their bottom line, perhaps. Obviously, they're very profitable. But I'm wondering if you think that that does a disservice to the public in Halifax by not really fostering that that kind of competition that you would see normally.
Sure. Can you hear me? Yes? Okay. All Nova Scotia over the last year has gone through a couple of periods where they blocked subscriptions from all local media. So if you worked for either of the local newspapers or CBC or Global, you had to get your someone with a different email address to sign up. I think it's bad for Halifax. I also think it's bad for All Nova Scotia. I also think it's stupid. Their competitive advantage is in their ability to break stories and get it first, and that is not in any way jeopardized by being followed by their competitors, because everyone knows when All Nova Scotia breaks something first, because of the kind of town that Halifax is. So I think that's actually a function of an internal battle. Well, you would probably know that better than I would, but an internal battle between David and Carolyn would be my guess. Am I right on that one? Yeah. So I think it's stupid, wrong, and they'll stop doing it. Yep.
I have three hands in the air. The lady here.
Hi, I'm Rana, and the question is to all of you. I mean, it could positively affect financing, but I'm just wondering, for co-op, independent, and community media, do you know who your readership is? Because I feel like what you're doing is laudable, but I feel like there's this huge layer of society that is disengaged. Like, even with the students, there are some students who don't even understand the student movement that's going on right now. Like, they're concerned with the latest fashion trends, and they have their... They're like, whatever, I can afford it, you know? And even with the strikes with Aveus and all the people being laid off or retirement age being, you know, like all these major things happening in this country, you feel like there's a portion of the population that just, you know? So are you thinking of these people as an independent, as independent journalists? Because I read your stuff, but if you're like me, I'm the only one in my circle of acquaintances and colleagues who comes to these conferences and who reads, you know, Media Co-op. So I think we need to reach to those people who are like, whatever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, clearly a lot of people are disengaged, but I mean, I think it's going to be a process. It's going to be a long battle to re-engage people in society and make people feel empowered, because I think... Even the student strike is as effective as it is, it's a, you know, deeply inadequate in terms of a mode of actual participation in society at large, which is still controlled by a very small number of people. So it's going to be a long battle. But at the same time, I mean, I think if you look at if you had told me a year ago that, you know, 300,000 or 200,000 people would march in the streets of Montreal, being the largest student demonstration in North American history, like I wouldn't have believed it. So I think that the process of getting people more engaged is just that, a process. And I think that it's going to, I think that when a few people do it, that becomes a sort of a layer that creates more space. And I think if we do things like create cooperative media, then it'll create more space for people to do more of the same.
Can I respond to that as well? Sorry, is this on? Actually, can I rant on that? There's an underlying assumption or narrative strain in this general conversation that's been going on for a few years of, to put it bluntly, how do we get people to read what we think is good for them? And it's starting to drive me crazy. One of the things that I think some people are doing really well, and I think the experimenters are doing really well, is to go look at what are the information needs of people and how do we fill them, because that's what we do as journalists. We give people the information that they need to make really good decisions. And there are all sorts of ways to do that. So that question of where's your audience and what do you know about your audience, I think is probably why David Bentley has succeeded with three very different audiences. You know, middle class, suburban was his first, and then with his Gossip Sheet it was different, and now he's going after the Mandarins. So that question of engagement and what you know about your audience and how you're serving it is. I'm going to stop ranting now.
Question, I see.
I have a question for Mr. J about the co-op. I'm a freelancer journalist, and how can we have good quality journalism if those people, those journalists, are not paid or paid as a member of the co-op, but the day-to-day doesn't bring bread on the table? How can we spend time reporting, spend a day, spend a few hours reporting stuff that's going to be on the website or on a co-op journal without thinking, what am I going to eat tonight?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the answer is, of course, that you can't. Like, we need to build up capacity to be able to pay journalists. But unfortunately, we're in a position where there isn't co-op financing, which is, you know, obviously the thing I think would be nice. There isn't that startup capital available to really make a go of it. So, and it's an experimental business model as well. So, and that we have to build political support for, you know, literally individual by individual. It's not this, you know, it's not like we went out and said, oh, the easiest way to pay for journalism is to create a model that no one has ever really made work, and then convince people, like, as individuals, one by one, painstakingly, to give us money to pay journalists to work on it. Like, that's not what happened.
Comment on fait pour faire du bon journalisme s'il n'est pas rémunéré? Parce que le temps aussi, c'est de l'argent. Hein, puis je pense que peu importe le citoyen qui travaille comme journaliste ou le citoyen qui répare des pneus, c'est un petit peu ça. Là, faire de la saucisse, là, il faut être payé pour faire la saucisse.
Hein. Yeah, I agree with you in terms of where we want to go. It's just
au niveau de la qualité, j'aimerais ça entendre à ce propos-là.
Yeah, I fully agree that to have high quality journalism, you need to pay for it. You need to pay people well and a living wage, no question. But at the same time, what we're trying to do is build something that does that in a democratic way, and that's a very marginal position. So what we're trying to do is get from where we are now, which is obviously not meeting your needs as a journalist, to what you're talking about. No, I mean, I totally agree that it's not meeting people's needs as professional journalists. I mean, I'm fully honest about that. And, you know, I volunteer my time for it, so it's not like... anyway, so the point is that it's going to take a long time to get there, and hopefully we'll bring more and more people like you on board as we go. But for the moment, it's not meeting those needs.
Okay, so I have two questions, and one is semi-related to what was just discussed. But, Drew, in your presentation, you talked about how there's sort of two kinds of content, and you distinguish between those to some degree. And so some of it, from what I understood, is paid, and you said that it sort of sets a standard, and that there's other sort of content that doesn't necessarily have to sort of rise above that standard, and you want to make the you want to distinguish, but you also want to sort of provide access. I find that really interesting. So I'd love to hear more about that broadly. But my actual question, if I had to boil it down, would be if you had to pick the things that are most different sort of between that higher standard and the sort of general content, what's that difference? So that's my first question. And then my second question is for Kelly, so I can go to that one first.
Okay. I mean, yeah, just briefly, like, the vast majority of our content is unpaid. That's just the reality. People create it because they're passionate about something. They create it because they have a strong interest, or because they want to get involved, or because they want to, you know, participate in some way. Those are the motivations. And then a small percentage of our stuff is paid. And you know, I'm the first to admit, not well. Nor are staff paid well. I mean, it's just the reality where we are. We're building something totally experimental and very marginal, so we're starting from zero. But in terms of how we operate on the website, basically, if you go to the Media Co-op website, you'll see in the right column, you'll see anything that's been posted, and it'll say at the top that, you know, this has not been evaluated by the editorial committee, and then certain things get featured, and then they'll say at the top, this has been evaluated by the editorial committee, and the featured stuff shows up in the left column, and it has a photo, and it's more prominent, and so on. So really, our goal is to give people the tools to understand the difference between stuff that meets some basic standards that we have for coverage, and stuff that doesn't, and then to pay for as much as possible under the circumstances.
My second question for Kelly was, what was your second recommendation?
Oh. Ah, Shelley, thanks. I've been a bit frustrated looking at all Nova Scotia at our inability to research it. And part of that is just the kind of perverse nature of the people who run it. But it's also a nature of how our research system is set up. So here are some of the questions I would like to know about all Nova Scotia. How much influence does it actually have on the public agenda? All of my sense of that is anecdotal. What percentage of its subscriptions are purchased by private corporations or government offices versus individual readers? How much of its success is due to unique organizational structure and hiring policies? How much of its subscription base is tied to service features? I didn't mention that they run a listing of every single major civil suit that's filed every day in Halifax. So how much of their success is tied to that? Would people subscribe without it? What other metrics or systems can be used to estimate the success of a business model like this? So if you look at the online sites that evaluate an online site, what's it worth? And they all use traffic and everything else. Well, according to whatsyoursiteworth.com, all Nova Scotia, if you wanted to buy it, should be worth $2,431. It's got revenues of $1 to $3 million a year. So I don't think that academic research is actually going to shed much light on these particular questions, or even, and I'd hate to be pessimistic, on a lot of the innovations in new media business models, because, for lots of good reasons, we have very careful deliberation, peer review, ethics rules. In other words, it's very difficult to be timely. Our research is slow. Ooh, Paul, you're grimacing, which means I need to talk to you later to find out how to do it fast. So new media models are rising and falling faster than academic research can respond. So if the public wants to influence and encourage new models for, public interest journalism, the kind of stuff that fosters civic society, then we should figure out a way to fund, and universities should figure out a way to allow research that can be done quickly, can be designed, executed, and disseminated quickly. Sorry, that was a long answer, Shelley, but I'd clearly written it down.
I would like to add one thing about the interest of the public and from this initiative, because I think that a very important thing is to stress that, for instance, for Quebecor, they are doing not so good journalism because they want to cut funds, cut costs, and that's why they are cutting down the journalist funds. I think that if we manage to find a way to, which, je vais continuer en français parce que je vais m'emmêler, je suis désolé. Je pense que si on arrive à trouver des moyens pour que pour ces initiatives, on va dire locales ou plus, enfin qui sont imprégnées d'une grande indépendance, d'une grande autonomie, qu'elles puissent avoir les moyens de faire du journalisme de très bonne qualité. Je pense que les gros groupes médiatiques comme Québecor, comme GESCA vont en profiter. Je m'explique, c'est-à-dire que l'exemple qu'on abordait aujourd'hui, c'était l'exemple de l'open data. L'open data, c'est à peu près le contraire de ce que fait Québecor. C'est-à-dire que Québecor diminue la qualité du journalisme pour diminuer les coûts. L'intérêt de l'open data, si on oblige les gouvernements à ouvrir leurs données, à ouvrir leur champ de décision aux journalistes, ça permet de faire du très bon journalisme avec un moindre coût. C'est un peu, on va dire, l'autre aspect. Et je pense que, certes, par exemple, All Nova Scotia va avoir une audience limitée. Mais si on arrive à favoriser ce type d'expérience, ce type de médias, et qu'ils réussissent à avoir les moyens financiers, les moyens, par exemple, aidés par l'État, aidés par les provinces, aidés par des instances publiques, de faire du journalisme de qualité, je suis certain que des groupes comme Québecor, qui ont tendance à s'imprégner, à récupérer les initiatives, surtout s'ils peuvent faire de la production à un coût limité, ce bénéfice pour le journalisme va se retrouver y compris dans les médias mainstream, comme Québecor, comme Jessica, dans les médias publics. Et donc, je pense qu'il ne faut pas non plus dire que ces expériences, le public n'en tire pas intérêt, parce que, au final, étant donné que les gros groupes médiatiques ont tendance à récupérer tout ce qui se fait dans le journalisme et tout ce qui se fait de manière positive, qui permet de créer des modèles d'affaires positifs qui sont viables, je pense qu'au final, dans un second temps, troisième temps, etc., on va retrouver, y compris dans les mainstream, mais donc dans les populations majoritaires au Québec. C'est-à-dire que la grande majorité du Québec, dans les populations, par exemple, qui ne sont pas forcément passées par l'université ou autre, elles vont bénéficier des progrès du journalisme et du progrès du journalisme qui est porté par un certain nombre d'organisations qu'il faut défendre aujourd'hui, et qu'il faut le défendre à la fois sur le financement, mais aussi sur ses capacités à acquérir de l'information de qualité.
Merci. I'm sorry, that's all the time we have. So the question that you were going to ask would be, you could ask it that the person after the workshop. I would like to remind you that tomorrow morning we will meet again, and that the objective is to write two recommendations that will be discussed at the General Assembly after that. As I can't be here tomorrow, I would like to know if someone who is bilingual would like to
be the spokesperson
tomorrow for that workshop tomorrow morning. So think about it. We'll see tomorrow morning who wants to do this nice job. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much, Paul, and then for everyone who presented today.
Yeah.
You've all done a tremendous amount of work, and we very much appreciate the effort that you've put into this. A couple of small housekeeping things for tonight. So we're going to go down the hill to the faculty club, and the address is 3450 McTavish. So it's literally just the other side of this major street that runs down here. It's one of those big old mansions on the right-hand side. There's a poster up front with the conference event on it. There are also, thanks to Gretchen, who has drawn little chalk arrows on the sidewalk. So if you see little white arrows on the sidewalk, they're leading you down to Thompson House. At the faculty club, rather, we will have three exceptional speakers, if not to put too much pressure on you. We have Joan Barata-Mir, who has joined us from Spain and who is going to be talking to us about lessons that we can learn from the way that civil society has handled media and policy in Tunisia. Craig Aaron from Free Press in the United States is going to talk about the movement that they've created to try to save journalism in the United States through public policy. And Michael Meadows has joined us all the way from Australia, and he's going to talk about, we all say that, well, nobody cares, people aren't engaged in politics anymore, and he's going to prove us wrong. He's going to talk about the community model in Australia and how that's actually starting to re-engage people. So I highly recommend that. After that, we'll give you a free drink. All you have to do is come back up the hill to Thompson House. And we won't be up here. We will be downstairs in the basement. We'll have drinks. We'll have nibbles. And we'll actually get a chance to talk about some of the things that you've all been dying to talk about through the day. Okay? Tomorrow morning, we start 8:30. We have breakfast, again, like this morning. First thing at 9 o'clock, we have a case study of open media, policy advocacy in Canada. And I don't know if any of you have been following it, but they have had an amazing success story over the last 2 years when it comes to internet policy. And then after that, as Paul has suggested, we are going to roll up our sleeves and get to work and actually hammer out some policies that we feel that we can realistically work toward here in Canada over the next few years. So thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to seeing you down at the Faculty Club.